Good morning. This Shabbat, of course, Shabbat Chayei Sara, and where I live, in Harei Chevron, Gush Etzion, which is actually Tzfon Har Chevron, there can be a lot of buses passing right past Tzomet Gush Etzion on their way to Chevron on Friday and on their way back on Motzei Shabbat. I don't know the exact numbers, but in past years, thousands, if not tens of thousands, have come to spend Shabbat cramped into the tiny little Jewish community of Hebron. Some walk from Kiryat Arba, people sleep in tents in the streets, students and the like. And I've always wondered what it is about Hebron that has the power to draw so many people there. The idea, of course, of going to spend Shabbat in Hebron on the Shabbat that we read about the purchase and to daven in Marat Machpelah and to read in Marat Machpelah about the purchase of Marat Machpelah, of course, that's very, very moving. But I get moved by very similar things all over this country. And I've taken people to all sorts of sites where you can read about things that happened in the Tanakh or sometimes visit them on the day in which these events occurred. And with the exception of Yerushalayim, which, of course, also has the power to draw tens of thousands of people. Ir David, I think, had over 1 million visitors last year, or 800,000 or something like that. Maybe it was 500,000, maybe I'm exaggerating. I don't remember the exact number, but very impressive numbers. With the exception of Yerushalayim, there's something about Hebron that that has the power to draw tens of thousands of Jews also on Chol HaMoed, both on Sukkot and Pesach every year. There are 2 days, and they get also tens of thousands coming to Hebron. What is it about Hebron that has this power more than other places? I even remember a few years ago, I don't remember if it was Beit El or Har Bracha, but hello. I don't remember if it was Beit El or Har Bracha, but a different yeshuv, a different Jewish town that's located in a place that was discussed in the Torah. If it was Beit El, then it was Parshat Lech Lecha when Avram went there. If it was Har Bracha, then it's the Parsha when Yosef bought Shechem. But one of these yeshuvim, I think it was Beit El, they figured they're going to get on the bandwagon and, you know, it'll help them too. They want to bring people to visit their town. So they tried to make a Shabbat. I think it was Shabbat Beit El Parshat Lech Lecha. And maybe some people went. I'm sure it was very, very nice. But nothing to the extent of what happens in Hebron. There's something about that place that draws deeply on the heartstrings of a Jew. And I'd like to try to figure out what it is. And I think that the place to look is actually in this week's parsha. So let's take a look. The parsha begins, of course. It's ironic. The parsha is called Chayei Sarah, the life of Sarah, but it actually discusses her death. Vayihiyu Chayei Sarah me'ah shana ve'srim shana ve'sheva shanim shnei Chayei Sarah. She lived for 127 years. Vatamot Sarah b'Kiryat Arba hi Chevron b'Eretz Kena'an, vayavo Avraham l'spod l'Sarah v'livkota. And a number of questions immediately jump out. Of course, the unusual way of mentioning Sarah's age, not 127 years, but 100 years and 20 years and 7 years. That's something that's noteworthy that I won't go into now. By the way, totally parenthetically, I was at a shir a few weeks ago, and someone pointed out, I had never noticed this, that Sarah, he claimed, is the only woman in the entire Tanakh about whom we're told her age when she died. I don't know the significance of that, but it's worth thinking about. That's just parenthetical, especially because I don't know the significance. I'm not going to talk about it, but I'll throw that out there. But after that, we have a few other questions. The Tanakh Sarah b'Kiryat Arba hi Chevron. The Torah goes out of its way to give us two different names for the same place. Today, of course, by the way, the name Kiryat Arba refers to a town that's just outside of Hebron. That's a modern phenomenon. But in biblical times, Kiryat Arba, it says here, Hi Hebron. There are two names for the same place, and yet the Torah decides to tell us both of the names. And even more perplexing is, Vayavo Avraham, Lispod Lisara Velivkota. Avraham's beloved wife of many, many years had died. And he cried, and he eulogized her before burying her. That makes sense. But Vayavo Avraham, he came to eulogize her and to cry for her. That, of course, leads us to ask, where did he come from? Why was he not with her when she died? So Rashi tells us, Mi Be'er Sheva. Sarah died in Hebron, but Avraham came from Be'er Sheva. And in order to understand why Rashi said that, we need to get a whole chronology of Avraham's life here. Let me first go through with you Rashi's understanding of this pasuk and those that came before it, and a little bit of what came afterwards. And then we'll see two other possible interpretations of the same series of events. Rashi wants to know where Avraham came from, if he came to Hebron. And Rashi says, well, obviously he came from Be'er Sheva. Why would you assume he was in Be'er Sheva? So Rashi tells us in the next pasuk, in the next phrase of this pasuk, L'spod l'sara b'livkota, v'nismicha mitat sara la'akedat Yitzchak, l'fi she'al yidei b'sorat ha'akeda, she'nizdamein b'na l'shchita, u'kim'at she'lo nishchat, parcha nishmata mimena v'meta. Rashi tells us something very, very tragic. The institution of Parshat HaShavua, the fact that we read a parsha every week and divide the Torah up that way, is an incredible educational device that the rabbis invented. It's remarkable what this device of Parshat HaShavua has done for us. But it does have at least one drawback, and that is that in our minds, the parshiot become separate units, sort of artificially. Because for us, an entire week has passed since we read about, by now, till next Shabbat. Or as a Rebbe of mine once said, cholent has this ability to make you forget, right? What you eat in between. But in actuality, Perek Chav Gimel, Parshat Chayei Sarah, of course follows immediately Perek Chav Bet, the end of Parshat Vayera. It's not if we don't call it Parshat Vayera and Parshat Chayei Sarah, if we simply say that this is chapter 22 of Bereshit and this is chapter 23, it flows immediately. And in fact, in chapter 22 of Bereshit, we're told of two events. The majority of the Perek tells us the story of Akedat Yitzchak. And at the end of Akedat Yitzchak, we are told, the last pasuk of that sentence, after Avraham almost slaughtered his son, after the malach came to him and the son was saved, etc., he then is told, he's given a bracha, and the end of the story is Vayashov Avraham on the Arav, right? Remember, he left the two lads with the donkey, and he and Yitzchak went. He returned to the donkeys, leaving, of course, open the question where Yitzchak was. That's also an interesting question, which we won't discuss. But the key point is, Vayelchu yachdav el be'er shava, Vayeshev Avraham be'er shava. At the end of the story of the Akedah, Avraham went to Be'er Shava. And then immediately after that, it tells us, Vayhi acharei hadvarim ha'ele. Immediately after that, implying that these two things happen simultaneously, or in close proximity. Vayhi acharei hadvarim ha'ele, this is the very end, we read this as maftir last Shabbat, the last few psukim. Vayhi acharei hadvarim ha'ele, vayugad l'Avraham l'mor, hinei yalda milka gam hi banim l'nachor achicha. Avraham receives a message. He, of course, we talked 2 weeks ago about Lech Lecha, how Avraham left his family behind. He left his whole family behind and made Aliyah. And like we spoke about, those who are here, that those of us who are Olim can relate to this type of thing. One of the major challenges of Aliyah is that you often leave family behind abroad. Today, of course, with telephones and internet and all sorts of things, we can get immediate news, but in those days it wasn't that way. So somebody, doesn't say who, somebody brought Avraham a message. You should know that your family, he had a brother who was still alive, you should know, and he had some nieces also, that that your brother has had a bunch of children and grandchildren and a list of descendants. And among the many, he's told about a number of boys and a number of girls that were born as descendants of his brother Nachor, and included this was Bituel. Nachor had a son, Bituel. And Bituel yaladet Rivka. Among the people that were born to Bituel was Rivka, who later, of course, will marry Yitzchak, the son of Avraham. And he finds out about his great niece, future daughter-in-law, that she was born. So we find, according to this, that Rivka was born approximately at the same time as the Akedah. Because after the Akedah, well, one could have suggested maybe she was born earlier and he only found out about it, but so it's implied. And immediately after that, without saying Acharei HaDvarim Ha'eleh, immediately after that, we have Vayihu Chayei Sarah. Rashi, therefore, adopts the approach that since these three events are presented to us in quick succession, first the Akedah, then Avraham hearing about, among other things, the birth of Rivka, and then Sarah dying. The second event, the news of Rivka's birth, was preceded with the phrase "Vayi acharei hadvarim ha'ele," implying that it happened then. The third parsha, the story of Chayei Sarah, it doesn't say. One could suggest that years or decades may have passed, but Rashi assumes, based on the Midrash, that these three things happened in quick succession, and that therefore there must be a connection, and what Rashi determines is a tragic connection between the death of Sarah and Akedat Yitzchak. That according to this, Sarah died actually as a result of Akedat Yitzchak. She heard. Again, the phrase based on Midrashim. Rashi didn't make this up. He's just adopting rabbinic traditions. Nismicha. I'm reading this again now. Nismicha mitat Sarah l'akidat Yitzchak. The death of Sarah was juxtaposed in the pasuk with the story of Akidat Yitzchak. Lefisha al yedei besorata akidah. After hearing the news, but only part of the news, she nizdamein benal shchita. She heard that her husband was about to slaughter her son. It doesn't say how she heard. He was almost slaughtered. It doesn't make clear in this version of the Midrash whether she actually thought he was slaughtered or found out that he wasn't, but in any case, the stress of hearing such a traumatic thing, parcha nishmata, caused her to die. And she died as a result of the Akedah, kind of a tragic end to what we thought was a story with a happy end. So understands Rashi. By the way, you should know that if you accept this chronology, namely, that Akedat Yitzchak and the birth of Rivka and the death of Sarah all took place at approximately the same time, two interesting things come out. One is a point that many of us have heard, but no one, I don't know, a lot of people don't understand the source of it. Many are aware that there's a rabbinic tradition that when Rivka married Yitzchak later on, she was a very young girl, only 3 years old. The source for that, right, you've heard such a tradition? Yeah. The source for that tradition is this idea. Because we know for a fact that at the time that Sarah died, Yitzchak was 37 years old. How do we know that? Because he was born when Sarah was 90, and she died at 127. So when she died, he was 37. If she died at the same time as the Akedah, and if Rivka was born at the same time as the Akedah, then Rivka was born when Yitzchak was 37. Yitzchak married Rivka, it says explicitly, when he was 40. If you accept all of that, that's how you have to say that Rivka must have been only 3 when she got married. If you accept that connection. You don't like that. Okay. So hold on to that thought. We'll return to it in a few minutes. Okay. If you accept that connection, that Rivka was born at the same time as the Akedah, and Sarah died at the same time as the Akedah, then you must say, we know for a fact that Yitzchak, we don't know how old she was from the text, we know that Yitzchak was 40 when he married her. If she was born at the same time that Sarah died, he was 37 when Sarah died, she'd have to be 3 years old. But something else also comes out of that chronology. It also means that Yitzchak at the Akedah was a man of 37 years old. Right? When we read the story of the Akedah, it doesn't exactly sound that way, right? It sounds like the image you have, I think, is of a young man. He says, Abba, where's the Seh Le'olah, right? And if you accept this chronology, then it means that Yitzchak was a man of 37 years old. Certainly physically able to resist, had he chosen to, his elderly father, right? His father would have been 137 at that time, according to this chronology. And Yitzchak was 37. If that's true, that means that Yitzchak completely, as an adult of sound mind and body, willingly submitted to the Akedah. It wasn't that he was a small child who didn't understand or couldn't resist. That would put a whole different thing. We would have to ask who the real hero of Akedah Yitzchak is. Is it Abraham? Or maybe Yitzchak? Okay, all that comes out of this chronology. And therefore Rashi says, since we were told that Abraham went to Beersheba at the end of the Akedah, and Sarah died at the same time in Hebron, so he must have come from Beersheba to Hebron. That's why it says that she died, and he had to come to her, because she was in Hebron and he was in Beersheba. Right? Because again, after the Akedah it says he went to Beersheba, she died at the time of the Akedah in Hebron, so he had to come, he heard his wife died, he had to come to Hebron. That's how Rashi understands this pasuk of Vayavo Avraham l'spod l'sarav livkota. Of course, though, there's an important question that needs to be asked, which is, if his wife was in Hebron, why did he go to Beersheba? Or, if he went to Beersheba, why did she die in Hebron? I understand that if he went to Beersheba and she died in Hebron, he would have to come, but what's going on there? Where were they living at this time? Did they live in Beersheba? Did they live in Hebron? Where did they live? In order to understand that, we have to go back and, again, right now we're doing this whole thing according to Rashi. If we go back to Parshat Lech Lecha, when Avraham first entered Eretz Canaan, so you find the following thing happened. In Parshat Lech Lecha, we're told in Perek Yudbet of Bereshit, Avraham came into Eretz Canaan. You know, maybe I'll do a little map here. Just so we understand what we're talking about here. Right, here's our amateur map of Israel, of Eretz Israel, right? Okay, right? Okay, Yerushalayim would be around over here, okay? Hebron around here, and Beersheba that's a little bit too exaggerated. Beersheba. Okay, now, when Abraham first entered Eretz Canaan, the very first time, it tells us, Bereshit Yudbet Vav, Vayavor Avram Ba'aretz, Ad Mekom Shechem, Ad Elon Moreh. Abraham entered Eretz Canaan from here. And his first place was Shechem, the first place he came to. When he first entered Eretz Canaan, he came to Shechem. But he didn't stay in Shechem. He gets there, and what does he do? He blesses God, he builds a mizbeach. That's Pasuk Zayin. And Pasuk Chet, Vaya'atek misham ha'hara mikedem leveitel. He then continues his travel. After he made the brit with Avimelech and settled in, named the place Beersheba, it tells us, Vayagor, at the very end of Perek Chafalef, Vayagor Abraham be'eretz plishtim yamim rabim. He dwelled in the land of the Plishtim, the land ruled by Avimelech, which includes Beersheba, Yamim Rabim, for a long time. How long? So here Rashi uses interpretive license and says, Yamrim Rabim, what's considered a long time? Mirubim al shel Hebron. It means he lived there longer than he lived in Hebron. He lived in Hebron for 25 years, so he must have lived in the land of Plishtim for 26 years. And then where did he go? Well, we know where he went. He went back to Hebron. How do we know that? Because Sarah died in Hebron. So according to Rashi, Avram lived in Hebron from the age of 75 to 99. From 99 to, let's say, 125, 26 years, and then moved back to Hebron. If that's true, then where was he living at the time of the Akedah? In Hebron. So that's why when Sarah died, she was in Hebron. The only question would then be, why did he go to Beersheba? And Rashi there, now I'm back, after going back to Lech Lecha through Vayera, now we're back at the end of Vayera again. Vayelchu Yachdav, after the Akedah El Beersheba, Vayeshev Avraham Beersheba. Rashi, it says he lived in Beersheba. But wait a second, he was living in Hebron. Rashi says, Lo Yeshiva Mamash. It doesn't mean that he really... I'm now at Rashi at the end, at the Perek Chaf Bet Pasuk Yud Tet, right, the very end of Vayera. It doesn't mean that he actually lived in Beersheba, in Beersheba, because he was already living in Hebron for 12 years. Again, Rashi's position is at the age of 125, he moved back to Hebron. Now he's 137. Sarah's 127, he's 137. So he's already been living in Hebron again, in his second Hebron stint, for 12 years. So when it says he went to Beersheba and he lived in Beersheba, it doesn't mean he really lived there. It just means he went there for a couple of days. So says Rashi. Okay. So if we accept this whole approach, and we don't have to, because I'm going to tell you two others. Okay? But Rashi pieced together the following scenario. He lived in Hebron from 75 till 99. It is there that he received the Besorah, the news that Yitzchak would be born. They then traveled to Be'er Sheva, lived there for 26 years until he was 125, returned to Hebron at the age of 125 with a son who was 25 years old at the time, lived there for another 12 years until the Akedah and his wife died, and for some strange reason, which Rashi doesn't explain, he chose at the end, after this dramatic moment of the Akedah, instead of going right home back to his wife, he decided to make a detour and go first to Be'er Sheva, and he happened to be there in Be'er Sheva when his wife died, and therefore he had to run back home to Hebron. That's the way Rashi puts the whole thing together. And again, it leaves us with the question of why did he go to Be'er Sheva if his wife was in Hebron?
How could he go back to his wife after he
Okay, so what I think you might be hinting at is an interpretation that I've heard a number of times from contemporary people. I've heard a number of contemporary rabbis or biblical commentators make the following suggestion, which I have not seen in any classical sources. I didn't say it's not there, but I haven't seen it. Not in Chazal, I haven't seen it in the Rishonim or in the Achronim. But there are those contemporary people, and I'm not very comfortable with this myself. I'm not sure what I think, so I'll just suggest it. But this is not one of the three I was going to suggest. But there are those who suggest that this implies some sort of tension between Abraham and Sarah, perhaps as a result of the Akedah, right? That he left his wife, perhaps over her objections, and therefore felt he couldn't go back to her. They separated, if you will.
But also Yitzchak's not with him.
And we don't know where Yitzchak is either. Right. So I've seen a number of contemporary authors who've noticed all these points and have seen in this the hints of some sort of drama, family tension, marital tension, maybe ideological tension between Avram and Sarah, that they separated. He didn't divorce her, but they separated, that they could no longer live together. Whether she threw him out or he did, whatever, that she objected to the Akedah, he left Yitzchak, wherever he is in this scheme, maybe he went back to his mother perhaps, or I don't know what, or wanted to. Avram felt he couldn't go back to his wife, instead went to Be'er Sheva, and tragically she died, and then he had to come and bury her. That's a suggestion I've heard, but I haven't seen that in any classical sources. But frankly, based on the analysis we've done so far, you can see where perhaps there may be hints to such a possibility. But Rashi's whole chronology leaves us with a number of... It solves the technical questions. It leaves us, however, with a number of difficulties, right? Susan was, bothered by Rivka being 3. Yitzchak being 37 at the Akedah is not necessarily a difficulty, but it's certainly a significant outcome of that and changes a lot of things. And the big question of why would he go to Be'er Sheva after the Akedah, which we suggested a possibility. I'm aware of two other ways of approaching this, each one of which rejects one of the assumptions made by Rashi. Okay, one of them is a midrash. A midrash that accepts most of the points of the chronology of Rashi, except doesn't, with the exception of the idea that they had returned to Hebron after 26 years in Be'er Sheva. The midrash that I'm referring to now does not assume that, but rather assumes that the rest of the chronology fits. That they were 75, from 75 to 99, Avram lived in Hebron, and after that moved to Be'er Sheva, and stayed in Be'er Sheva. And that the Akedah, when he left for the Akedah, he left from Be'er Sheva. Which, by the way, I'll get in a minute to the Ramban, who's the third position that I'm going to share with you. The Ramban points out that it takes about 3 days to walk from Be'er Sheva to Yerushalayim. It takes only about 1 day to walk from Hebron to Yerushalayim. So, we know it took 3 days. So that certainly strengthens this possibility. The Ramban says that if you want to assume what Rashi assumes, you'd have to say, why did it take 3 days? God told Avraham, go to Eretz Moriah and bring him as a korban al achad heharim asher omar elecha, on one of the mountains that I will show you. And if it took 3 days, the Ramban said, Ramban, who himself we'll see, doesn't agree with this, but Ramban explaining what Rashi would have to say, Rashi would have to assume that he traveled from Hebron to Yerushalayim, and when he got there, he didn't know, he had to spend the next 2 days wandering around the general Yerushalayim area until Hashem showed him the mountain, because it doesn't take 3 days. And that would also perhaps put a whole spin on the Akedah story, because it just increases the tension that Avraham must have been through. Right? He could have done this already in 2 more days of wandering around. But if we don't assume that they returned to Hebron, so then they left from Be'er Sheva. And then that explains why it took 3 days to get to Yerushalayim. And it also explains why Avraham went back to Be'er Sheva after the Akedah. That all makes sense. He lived in Be'er Sheva, he went to Yerushalayim, he went back to Be'er Sheva. And it says that he returned to his home in Be'er Sheva. But, why did Sarah die in Hebron? Says this Midrash, because she was on her way to Yerushalayim. According to this Midrash, Avram left Be'er Sheva and went to Yerushalayim to do the Akedah, and Sarah heard what was happening and she ran after them to try to stop him. He traveled from Be'er Sheva to Yerushalayim. She was on her way following, and when she got to Hebron, says the Midrash, the Satan showed her an image, a vision of Yitzchak on the Mizbeach. Showed her a vision of something. Showed her a vision of what was happening at this moment in Yerushalayim. At this moment in Yerushalayim, by the time she got to Hebron, the Malach had already come to Avraham and told him, Al tushlach yadcha al anar. Avraham had removed Yitzchak from his Mizbeach and in his place sacrificed the ayil. At that moment, Sarah was running through Hebron, desperately on her way to try to stop this event, which Yitzchak had already been saved, but the Satan at that moment showed her an image of a burning korban, something that had been slaughtered and placed on the Mizbeach. It was actually the ayin, the happy end. But tragically, she didn't understand that. She assumed that what she was seeing was Yitzchak, and she died there in Hebron. Avraham, not knowing this, went back to Be'er Sheva to tell his wife the wonderful news that Yitzchak was saved, only to find out that tragically she had died in Hebron. He had to turn around and go back to Hebron. Vayavo Avraham l'spod l'sara l'livkota. That's a second possibility. The third possibility is the Ramban himself. The Ramban very often will approve of an interpretation that he thinks works best with the text of the Tanakh, even if he has to reject various Midrashei Chazal. Many of the Midrashim that they teach our children as if it was a fact, because Rashi quotes it, not only are not the biblical text itself, but a Midrashic interpretation, not only are they not the only possible interpretation, but the Ramban often is the one who rejects them. And they don't teach that often to our children, which is unfortunate. The Ramban actually accepts Rashi's chronology, that they lived in Hebron from Avram's age of 75 to 99, and then in Be'er Sheva till 126, and then moved back to Hebron. Agrees, therefore, that Sarah died in Hebron at the age of 127 because that's where she lived, but does not assume that the Akedah, that Sarah died immediately after the Akedah. According to the Ramban, the Akedah happened during the period of time when Avram was living in Be'er Sheva, which means that Yitzchak was no older than 25 at the time of the Akedah, but he could also have been 10. Okay? And, however, so Yitzchak could have been a child. And by the way, Rivka then could be no younger than, Rivka could be no younger, the youngest she could possibly be when she married Yitzchak is 15. And she could also be 20, 25, or 30. Right? Because if she was born at the time of the Akedah, and the Akedah happened when Yitzchak was somewhere between 1 and 25, right? And he gets married at the age of 40, so that's the range. So Rivka's a, right? So you like this, Susan, right? Rivka's a, you know, at least 15, and quite possibly even.
It bothers me that right. A 3-year-old would be sitting on a camel and.
Although, on the other hand, if she's a 25-year-old woman, then we have to wonder, you know, okay, it's ancient time, but you know, right? The whole negotiations are with her parents, and okay, but this was a different society. It could be, right? Women, whatever the story is, but it also means, therefore, that Sarah's death had nothing to do with the Akedah. She was alive and well before, during, and after the Akedah, and lived for many, many more years, and moved happily with her husband and son to Hebron, and died. And there's no connection between the Akedah and Hebron. There's none of that. Avram returns from the Akedah to Beersheba, because that's where he lives, and Terah dies years later in Hebron. And then the only question is, the question we started, what does it mean, Vayavo Avraham? And for that, the Ramban says, the whole question is not important. He says, don't take that word seriously. Vayavo just means he prepared himself, right? He got up, maybe he came from the next room. The point is, he was about to eulogize his wife. It wasn't a spontaneous, he prepared himself and he got up and he gave a eulogy. That's all it means, right? So Ramban throws the whole discussion we just had out the window and says, this is the explanation. Okay, so that was a very, what's his name? Oh, okay. So that was a very interesting, detailed analysis of trying to piece together the biblical story from the various clues in the text. But now let's return to the question. Yes, sure. Okay. The Ramban accepts, unlike the Midrash, the Ramban accepts Rashi's chronology of Abraham's place of residence, right? He lives first in Hebron, then Beersheba, back to Hebron. Where he differs with Rashi is he severs the connection, which is not in the text, right? The Akedah is told to us after the Akedah, right after the Akedah, I'm sorry. It tells us about the Akedah, tells us that he heard about Rivka's birth. Those two things do seem to be connected. And then the next story in the Torah is that Sarah died. But it doesn't say it happened right away. So Ramban does not assume like Rashi did that the two happened at the same time. And he says, since I know that Abraham lived in Beersheba from the age of 100 to 120, 99, let's say, to 125. And I know that it's a three-day walk from Beersheba to Yerushalayim. And I know it took him 3 days to get to Yerushalayim. And I know that after the Akedah, he returned to Beersheba and lived in Beersheba. I'm going to assume that the Akedah happened sometime during that period of time. And Sarah's death happened completely later on. So he agrees with everything with Rashi's chronology, except when the Akedah was. If the Akedah is earlier, first of all, Yitzchak's younger at the Akedah. Second of all, Rivka's older when she gets married. And third of all, Sarah's death has nothing to do with the Akedah. And she didn't die because of the Akedah, and she didn't die immediately after the Akedah, and assumedly she knew very well that Yitzchak was alive and lived through that and had many happy years with Yitzchak until she eventually died at the age of 127. And then the only question is, and it makes perfect sense, therefore, that he returned to Beersheba from the Akedah because that's where he's living, and years later when Sarah died, they were living in Hebron, and that's why she died in Hebron. The only question is, why did he come to her? And he says that's all it means is that he came, either if you want to say he came from one tent to the next tent, or he just metaphorically came to this moment, that's all it means. Okay? But besides the, I think, very interesting discussion of trying to piece the pieces of the puzzle together and contemplate the ramifications this has for us in understanding the nature of the Akedah and understanding the nature of the marriage between Yitzchak and Rivka. And by the way, it's not only a question of how old she was when she got married. It has a lot to do also with the whole relationship that they later on had. Are they two people of approximately the same age? A man who's married to a woman 3 years younger than he, or a man who's married to a woman who was 37 years younger than he was, and he married her as a child and basically raised her as her husband? That's a very different type of relationship. And the question of the relationship Yitzchak has with Rivka, there's a lot of ramifications too, also when it comes to the way they dealt with their children later. Ve'ein kan makom laharich, but there's a lot in there. But besides all that, regardless, and now I want to return to the point we started with, regardless of which of these interpretations you take, There's something in here about Hebron. If we start by asking, what is it about Hebron? In each of these interpretations, there's something unique about Hebron. If we assume, like Rashi and the Ramban do, that Abraham lived in Hebron, that was his first place of residence, we know, that's a fact. His first place of residence in Eretz Canaan was Hebron. He lived there for 25 years. He then, at some point, left Hebron for, Rashi suggested, two possible reasons. Maybe it was a different reason. But that's a normal thing. People settle someplace, they live someplace for 25 years, and then they move. That happens. Whatever reason he had. And then he lived in Beersheba for another significant period of time. Something would have then, if we accept Rashi or the Ramban's understanding that they then returned to Hebron, there must be a reason for that. Right? That's already a little bit less common. It's not unheard of either, but he lived in Hebron, he moved from Hebron, and then after he went back to Hebron, and here we don't have any piece of information that we can suggest. Sodom hadn't been rebuilt, as far as we know. It still hasn't been rebuilt. Right? Lot, did Lot die at that? I don't know. But what brought him back? There's something, Hebron seems to be some kind of a magnet. If we don't go with that approach, if we take the approach, the second approach I suggested, the approach of the Midrash, so then Avram's chronology is much more simple. He lived in Hebron for 25 years. For whatever reason, it was time to move. He moved to Beersheba, and then he lived in Beersheba. Zeo. And Sarah died in Hebron sort of just by happenstance. But it's not really by happenstance, is it? She didn't die randomly. She was on the way to try to stop the Akedah. And the Satan, however you understand that idea of the Satan, whatever the image there is meant to be, right? But that the Satan showed her this scene that Yitzchak had been replaced by the Ayo, but in a way that she didn't understand, and it caused her death. And she just happened to be in Hebron at that time? Or is there something, in other words, is there some divine providence or something that requires that Sarah die dafka in Hebron, which according to this approach was not her place of residence, was just a stop on the road where she happened to be traveling at that moment, but not just happened. It's at that moment that the Satan chose to reveal himself to her and to cause her death dafka there. In other words, if you don't say that they moved back to Hebron in their lifetime, then Sarah was brought to die specifically in Hebron. So if we want to understand what is it about Hebron, either, however you sort this whole puzzle out, there's something there about Hebron. Now let's continue Parshat Chayei Sarah. So Sarah died, and Avram had to bury her. He needs a grave. Pasuk Gimel. Vayakom Avraham me'al pnei meto, vayedaber al bnei chet lemor, Ger v'toshav anuchi imachem. That's also a fascinating expression. Ger v'toshav. It's an oxymoron. I am a stranger and a resident. Right? Rabbi Soloveitchik wrote an essay by that title, using this oxymoronic phrase as what he described as emblematic of, this goes back a little bit to what we spoke about 2 weeks ago, the nature of the Jew. Always at the same time a stranger and a resident. Part of the world and yet apart from the world. Or Rashi tries an interpretation that that tries to sort of square the two and say, well, I'm a stranger in the sense that this is not my homeland. I'm an immigrant, someone who's came from abroad, but I'm now already a resident here. I'm a former ger who is now a toshav. But in any case, there's something in that expression that sort of expresses the somewhat precarious position that Avram had in Eretz Canaan. Remember, he was told to leave his place of residence and come to Canaan, and Hashem told him repeatedly, this is going to be your land, Lazarecha natati et haaretz hazot, multiple times. But in Avram's personal life, he didn't see that. V'haknaani az ba'aretz, it says in Parshat Lech Lecha. When Avram first came here, there were other people living in the land, and he was very much, and you see, he doesn't own land. Avram was what we would call today a Bedouin, right? He wasn't a farmer. We don't read about him having fields. Yitzchak, like Yizra Yitzchak. Yitzchak eventually planted a field. We don't read that about Avram. Avram was nomadic. He lived in tents. He had sheep. What we call today a Bedouin. He doesn't own land. And finally, the first time that we hear of Avram buying a piece of land and becoming what you might call a resident was not to buy a home and a farm, but to buy a grave. With that insight, look, and let's read these psukim that we've read many times, and let's try to be sensitive to the language here, because I'm going to show you something now that I think is also highly significant. He says to them, "Ger v'toshav anochi imachem." That's his introduction. And what is he about to ask for? He needs to buy what? A grave, right? What would you expect him to call? How do we say grave in Hebrew? Kever, right? So he should ask for a kever. He does, but there's another word there. Tenuli, he says, achuzat kever imachem ve'ekbira meiti milfanai. I need you to please provide for me a grave. But he uses the expression achuzat kever. The word achuza. On the one hand, means an estate. Okay, it refers usually to a large territory with fields and other things. So perhaps what he's trying to say is, I don't want, graves in those days were caves, burial caves, artificial caves that had been carved into the rock. But he's not asking only for the grave. He's asking perhaps for the whole plot of land around the grave, right? Which perhaps can just mean that he wants, you know, he wants to build some kind of, he doesn't want to just have the burial cave. He wants to have maybe some kind of monumental structure or something. But the word achuza, right, the shoresh, the Hebrew word, root of achuza is le'echoz. Le'echoz means to hold on to grab, to hold, right? To grasp, that's the word I was looking for, thank you. To grasp. Today, in modern Israeli parlance, right, when you have these settlers who don't have permission to build a new yeshuv and they go out and they start one anyway, right? So in the English news, they call those outposts, or sometimes they call them illegal outposts, or whatever term they want to use. But you know what the Hebrew term for those are? Ma'achaz. Right? Because what are they trying to do, basically? Trying to seize the land, grab hold of the land. And that's the term that Avram used. I wanted achuzat kever. And I'm going to suggest that that term was not incidental. Now, let's read the lengthy description, unusually lengthy description, of the negotiations he has to buy this piece of land. Vaya'anu v'nei chet et Avraham le'mor lo. They responded to him, Shmainu Adoni, Nesi Elohim ata betochenu. They offer, they say to him, they speak to him with great respect, they say, we have great respect for you, we very much, honor you. B'mivchar kvareinu kvoret meitecha. Ish mimenu et kivro, lo yichle mimcha, mikvor meitecha. You can choose the best of our graves. Nobody would try to hold back his grave from you. Any grave you want, you can have. Very nice offer, but did they offer him what he asked for? Maybe they thought they did. He asked for achuzat kever, and what did they offer him? A kever. They said, any kever you want. And he responds very nicely, but he doesn't back down. Vayakum Avraham vayishtachu la'amaretz levnei chet. He bows to them by the very time anymore. He says, okay, if you're offering me any kever I want, I'll tell you which one I want. Im yeshet nafshechem l'kiboret meitim yilfanai, if you're going to allow me to bury my wife here, shmauni ufiguli befron ben sochar. You tell me any grave I want, this is what I want. I want you to approach a certain individual named Ephron ben Sochar. V'yitenli, and I want him to give me et mi'arat ha-machpelah asher lo, asher b'ktzei sadehu. Name's a very specific place. He tells him, b'chesef malei yitneneli, I want to buy it for the full price. Why? La'achuzat kever. He says again, I don't want just a kever, I want an achuzat. And again, they have this whole negotiations. Ephron, sincerely or not sincerely, depends how you read it, says, you don't have to pay for it, I'll give it to you for free. And Avram says, no, I insist. And he says, well, you know, what's 400 shekels? But 400 shekels, I saw an estimate when someone tried to figure out it. $150,000 or something, based on the weight of silver and what it would be worth today, a lot of money.
Bucks.
Yeah, what's that between you and me? And Avram hears very well what he says, right? And assumedly, by the way, if you're negotiating, so any good negotiator knows, right? When you're trying to sell something and you offer the price, so your starting price is inflated, right? The seller offers a higher price and the buyer higher than he really wants to hopes to get, and the buyer offers less than he's willing to pay, and they right? So he says, 400 shekels. You know, what's that between you and me? You can have it for free, meaning that you know he's expecting Avram to give him a second. Say, no, I want to pay for it, but you know. How about 250, right? And they'll settle on 320 or something, right? Avram says, no problem. Here's 400 shekels, right? Pays for it, assumably an inflated price. And the story ends with Pasuk Yud Zayin, Vayakom Sdei Ephron Asher B'machpelah Asher Lifnei Mamre Hasadeh V'hamiara Asher Bo V'chol Ha'etz Asher B'sadeh B'chol Gvulol Saviv La'Avraham L'mikna L'einei B'nei Chet B'chol Barei Sha'ar Yiro. So it tells us that he actually bought the field, not just the cave, but the entire field where the cave was located, all the trees that were in the field. He bought a piece of land, which included the grave. Okay, so now we know he bought it. V'achareichen kavar Avraham et Sarai Yishto Emeratza Machpelah Ematzdei Machpelah Pnei Mamrei Chevron. The Eretz Kenan. That should be the end of the story. He bought the land and buried his wife. The Torah then goes and tells us again. Vayakom hasadeh v'hame'ara asher bo la'avraham la'achuzat kever me'ed b'nei chet. The end of the story is not that he buried his wife. The end of the story is that he acquired this land la'achuzat keder. Or to put it differently, the way the Torah seems to say it, it's not that he needed to buy the land so that he could bury his wife there, but rather, he wound up having to bury his wife there so that he could buy the land. Right? And if we, especially if we take the interpretation that she died specifically in Hebron, as it were, randomly. And by the way, he could have taken her back to Beersheba to bury her. Later on, Yaakov was taken from Mitzrayim to be buried in Hebron. He could have taken her to Beersheba, taken her home to bury her. No. She needed to be buried there. And he knew exactly where he wanted to bury her. Another rabbinic tradition says that the name Kiryat Arba, which some understand as simply that there was a guy named Arba and that was his land. That's how some understand it. But one rabbinic tradition assumes that Arba is a number four, and it would be the city of four. The city of four what? Arba is the number four, but in the feminine. So it would have to be four or something, some word that's a feminine word in Hebrew. Four zugot, four couples. According to this midrash, it's because there are four couples buried there. But of course, the Torah only tells us of three couples buried there. Abraham buried Sarah there, and he was later buried there. Yitzchak buried Rivka there, and he was buried there. Yaakov buried Leah there, not Rachel. Rachel is buried in, maybe, in Kever Rachel, maybe not. And he was buried there, that's three. According to the Midrash, though, there was a fourth couple. That's not
Adam,
those. Adam and Chava. Adam and Chava. And one Midrash even has that, how did Avraham know where he wanted to bury her? He knew it, according to this Midrash, because way back, when those Malachim came to him, 37 years earlier, telling him that he would have a son. He was in Elul Mamre. He was living in Hebron. And if you remember, the three angels came to him, and he said, "Oh, we have to host our guests." He's so excited. He runs to Sarah and says, "Bake bread." And he runs to go get an animal to chef the animal. He's going to make them a whole mango, right? She's making bread, and he's making. So, according to this midrash, he went to slaughter. He went to take the animal, the lamb, to slaughter it, and the lamb ran away. And he started chasing it. And it ran and it ran. He chased it and chased it and chased it. And it ran down to Sdei HaMachpelah, down from the city of Hebron into this field. And Avram chased this little lamb and it ran into this cave. And Avram followed it into the cave. And who did he see there? He saw Adam and Chava lying, who were dead for a couple thousand years, lying on beds with candles at their heads. And he understood that there's something about this place. And that's why he knew years later, this is where he has to bury Sarah. Take the Midrash, don't take the Midrash. There's something there. Later on, at the end of Sefer Breshit, Yaakov Avinu died in Mitzrayim. We know that before he died, at the very end of Sefer Breshit, he calls his son Yosef and he makes him take an oath. Al natik bereini b'Mitzrayim. I don't want to be buried in Mitzrayim. I want you to take the incredible difficulty in those days. And I want you to take me and bury me. Difficulty just because it was an incredibly long journey in those days, and difficulty because of the politics. He had to get special permission from Paro. I want to be buried in Eretz Israel. He said two things. I don't want to be buried in Eretz Mitzrayim. I do want to be buried in Eretz Canaan. But then he said a third thing. Not just anywhere in Eretz Canaan. It has to be in Me'arat Machpelah. That's where I want to be buried. And he describes it, not just because I want to be buried in that place. He describes it with this terminology. In Parshat Vayechi, the end of Sefer Breshit, he insists. I want you to bury me. No, I'm sorry, it's not there. It's when they actually bury him. I'm sorry. When they actually bury Yosef, Yaakov, the Torah goes out of its way to tell us. Vayisu oto vanav, perik nun, pasuk yud gimel, vayisu oto vanav arza kena'an, they took him from Mitzrayim all the way up to Eretz Canaan. Vayikberu oto bimi'aratz deh amachpela. Asher kana Avraham et hasadeh lachuzat kever me'et Ephron achiti al pnei mamre. As we didn't know what Marat HaMachpelah, it wouldn't be enough to say they buried him in Marat HaMachpelah. The Torah goes out of its way to tell us that's the cave that Avraham bought from Ephron achiti. We knew that. The Torah is telling us not for informational purposes, but for emphatic purposes. Right? I'll close with one thought, and I think this provides what I believe is the answer to the question we're talking about. You know, in recent years, there's been a significant phenomenon in Jewish people of growing and growing and growing popularity of visiting Kivrei Tzadikim, all sorts of grave sites, and people make pilgrimages to graves, even in Chutzlaretz, Uman, and other places, and certainly all over Eretz Yisrael. It's a phenomenon that I personally find somewhat troubling, and it's a phenomenon that I think is not really part of our tradition, although I can't deny that it does go back hundreds of years, but only hundreds of years, till sometime in the Middle Ages, till the Middle Ages. You don't really find this in the Gemara, you don't find it in the Talmud. The idea of visiting graves doesn't really seem to have been an authentic part of Jewish tradition from the beginning. And it's for that reason that many grave sites of even very important people, we just don't know where they are, because the Jews didn't seem to make such a... Even Moshe Rabbeinu's grave, the Torah tells us, we don't ever know where it is, right? And even Rachel, I hinted, it's not clear. The Ramban already questions whether Kever Rachel is really Kever Rachel. There are significant reasons I think it might not be, but that's not for now. And certainly, most of the other graves you see all over this country, you know, they differ between questionable traditions to absurdly ridiculous traditions that have, you know, no basis, to things that were made up 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. And I'm not exaggerating. Okay? And the reason for that is because until recent times, Jews didn't really place a major emphasis on visiting graves. But there is one exception to that rule, and that's Me'arat HaMachpelah. Me'arat HaMachpelah has always been, according to Chazal already, Kalev ben Yefuneh, right, when the Meraglim came up, and it says there, Vaya'alu b'negev, they went up in Zeretzof in the Negev, Vayavo ad Chevron, it switches from the plural to the singular. Chazal say, only Kalev went there. He went there to pray that he should have the strength to withstand the pressure from the other Meraglim. And the physical structure we see in Me'arat HaMachpelah, the building they say, the incredibly impressive and significant structure that's there, which was built by Herod 2,000 years ago and has remained intact to this very day. It's probably the oldest building in the world that is still 100% complete. It's been added to and changed, but the original structure is still there and has been used continuously for 2,000 years every single day since it was built for the purpose for which it was built. It was built to be a place of tefillah for Jews and non-Jews alike on the site of the graves of the Avot, and it has served that purpose for probably around 2,000 years and continues to do so. Right, which is in itself incredible, and it shows us that even when we weren't interested in graves and when we didn't have this phenomenon, there's an exception to that rule. The site of Me'arat HaMachpelah has always been a magnet. And perhaps there's something metaphysical about it. Maybe it has something to do with Adam and Chava being buried there or something else, or other Midrashim that talk about it as Petach Gan Eden, whatever that means. But certainly, it's the first place Avraham settled, the very first place when he first came into Eretz Canaan. It was in Hebron. He had his Brit Milah, was promised, it's here that you're going to get Eretz Canaan. That's where he was told that. He buried his wife there so that he could buy that spot. And that spot he bought as an achuzah, as a place, a magnet, buried deep in the ground are the roots of Am Yisrael. And I'll close with this thought. Ultimately, Hebron was not the capital of the Jewish people. Ultimately, the capital is, of course, Yerushalayim. But everything that, if you go to Ir David, their slogan is, Kana Kol Hitchil. It's not really true. Hakol itchil b'Chevron. Before David captured Yerushalayim, he had to first rule in Chevron. And Chevron is the word Chevron means chibur, means connection. And buried deep in the ground in Chevron are the roots of our people. And somehow I think the fact that tens of thousands of people will be traveling there to sleep in the streets this Shabbat, I think shows that that reality is buried deep in the heart of every Jew. And there's something therefore very, very deeply significant about that place. And if we have the privilege to be able to visit there, there's something that we can definitely draw from.